Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Did he really escape from a volcano? Did that really happen?
Yes.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Walter Mitty. Seriously. How the hell did you get up here?
I've been looking for you.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Wreckatopia episode 181. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Life Arenos.
Yes, and we're also welcoming in Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody. Hello.
Yes, and we'd also like to welcome chat who've come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you very much. Today's big recommend is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Can't wait to get into that. All right, let's get into our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And Jeremy, what do you got?
You guys, I have a lovely, delightful, airy little sugar cookie for you today. Called The Thursday Murder Club on Netflix. This is based on a book from 2020. I guess there are five books in the series now. I would consider this a cross between Only Murders in the Building and Man on the Inside. This is set in a very posh retirement home that appears to be a castle converted. And there is a Thursday murder club that meets to try and solve cold case murders. And it's Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, and Helen Mirren. And then a new resident stumbles upon their group. And then there's an actual murder that happens. And this crew tries to solve it. This is not Agatha Christie. This is not Knives Out level, blow you away with either performances or the mystery. But this is a delightful little hour and a half, 2 hour spend with some older actors who are clearly having a good time. The mystery is pretty solid, and it's just charming as all hell. My wife had read the book and wanted to watch the movie, and so I decided to watch it with her, even though this is not something I would typically be drawn to. But I really liked it. I thought it was delightful. And so it's on Netflix, and you can watch it now. And there you go.
Look at all those actors. Holy crap. I want to see it just based on that.
I think that's kind of my point. Yeah, if you think you would enjoy watching Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, and Helen Mirren, you know, sneak around trying to solve a murder, you will enjoy this.
And that's before you get to good old David Tennant hanging out in this movie as well, who's always fun to watch. This is like best case scenario for Netflix slop. You know what I mean? Like they have a movie that comes out every week that's just like, we just put all these pieces together and did a thing. And more often than not, it's kind of terrible. But this is, I think the genuine heart to it is what saves it. You know, it's just kind of fun, and you're enjoying yourself, and you're enjoying hanging out with these people, and everything you said is correct. So yeah, best case scenario for the Netflix slop.
Am I seeing Sissy Spacek there in the bottom right corner? Who is that?
No, it's, I don't remember her name.
That is Celia Imrie.
Thank you.
The actor's name.
Yeah, couldn't tell on the thumbnail there, but yeah, that looks a lot of fun.
Directed by Christopher Columbus.
So. Yes.
Well, there you go. Get the big old 1492 logo on that, I bet.
I don't remember, but it might have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. All right, Aaron, what do you got?
I saw Sweet Smell of Success.
It's such a good movie.
I agree. I loved it so much. I think a lot of times you think about the Hayes era movies and you think, well, they couldn't really do anything interesting or dark or, gritty. And this movie exists just to say, oh no, you can do dark and gritty. You can get away with it. You can figure out how to go there. Tony Curtis, Burt Lancaster, both kind of playing against type in this a little bit. Burt Lancaster plays J.J. Hunsaker, which is that where Hudsucker comes from? Every time they said Hunsaker, I thought Hudsucker.
I knowing the Coens, I would almost guarantee it came from this or something.
Right. Like they watch this movie and are like, that's a fun grouping of sounds and syllables. Let's do something like that. But Tony Curtis plays Sidney Falco, and they are kind of competing in the world of journalism. But basically, Tony Curtis wants to be Burt Lancaster in some ways. He's kind of an acolyte or, a toady in some ways and is doing his dirty work at times. But they're evil, man. They are just, they are not good people. And basically the story is about Burt Lancaster, who has all this power through his journalism. I think if I understand correctly, it's supposed to be like Walter Winchell was like the kind of the person the character's based on. But his sister, he doesn't like who she's involved with. And so he uses all his nefarious ways to break them up, and it gets dark. This movie gets really dark and interesting, but more than that, it is written so well. The dialogue in this movie is so crispy. Just quotable, great lines, great movie. One of Scorsese's favorites, I believe. This is good stuff. Check this one out.
Yeah, this seems so ahead of its time. It's a 1957 movie, but it feels like it's something that, Tarantino or somebody like that wrote, lines like the cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river and stuff like that.
It's very noir. It's almost like from a modern perspective, it can almost feel like a parody because it's so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, noir. Like, and that's the other thing about like Hudsucker. Like you look at why is her name slipping my brain in Hudsucker, who's so great?
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh. She is doing she is affecting this kind of style of delivery and stuff that they're doing. It's a lot of fun in that way.
Yeah, definitely second this one. I think I either small recommended this a long time ago on this show or did it on the other one. I'm not sure, but I know it was one that made an impression on me a few years ago, and definitely can second this one. Yep. Mine is from 1972. It's a movie called Sleuth, and it stars Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine. Mm-hmm. This movie was remade in 2007 with Michael Caine taking the Laurence Olivier role and Jude Law taking the Michael Caine role. The basic premise is Michael Caine is going to Laurence Olivier's house. He's a writer. He's got this huge mansion and he's got a big, huge hedge maze on the outside of it. You can tell immediately that Laurence Olivier is playing a character who's like very much into games and into, all kinds of games, head games and so on and so forth. But Michael Caine shows up to this mansion and they start having a discussion, and it's quickly found out through the discussion that Laurence Olivier knows that Michael Caine is sleeping with his wife and that that there's got to be something done about this because he also wants to leave his wife, but he wants to somehow profit off of it in a way. So what he wants Michael Caine to do is steal from him make it look really good. So like, it's like, I want you to steal these jewels out of a safe and I need you to make it look good. So he puts Michael Caine in a costume and he's like, you've got to do it this way and you got to do it this certain way, whatever. And then the movie gets to a certain point. I don't really want to go further than this, but there's a certain point where you don't know exactly what has happened. And in the next scene, there's an inspector asking one of these characters questions, and it sort of plays on your if you're like really into plays with small casts where everybody's sort of playing different characters and things like that, it sort of plays on your knowledge of those, because you're not quite sure where a lot of this is going, even though you might have figured out something here and there and whatever. But it's a really fun little, I guess, tete-a-tete type of movie where you know, you have two heavy-hitting actors. Michael Caine, I think he has become a big star at this point, but he apparently like did some sort of acting in one scene that Laurence Olivier commented on and said that was fantastic or whatever, that Michael Caine like felt really awesome about himself afterwards. You know, it was one of those things that to get that kind of feedback from a master and everything. But it is one of those movies that the less you know about it, it's the better to go into it. Just know that those two guys are amazing together. Some outdated racial stereotype type stuff in this, not like overboard or anything like that, but still stuff that, you know, you might have to give some leeway here and there in some of the dialogue choices that they make. But really good movie. I remember the remake being okay too. That was Kenneth Branagh directing that one, and I remember it being okay. I haven't seen it in forever since it came out, so I don't know how it
somehow
compares
seen.
To that.
I've somehow seen that remake like 3 times, and I've never seen the original. Yeah.
So there you go. All right. I will go on to introduce the big recommend, which is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And it is Jeremy's choice. So, Jeremy, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
All right, I better take a drink. I'm not going to be able to take a drink for the next 20 minutes.
That's true.
All right, Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Here we go. The film opens on Walter's checkbook, where we learn, if we are able to pause it quickly enough, as I was, that his mom is moving into a retirement home with her piano, and also Walter doesn't date anything in his ledger for anything he writes a check for or spends money on, and it's really bothering me. Anyway, if the use of color in this opening scene is any indication, I think Walter might be a little blue these days. We also see he's got a little crush on Cheryl Melhoff, but can't bring himself to send her a wink on eHarmony until he musters the courage and clicks it, but he keeps getting an error message. As Walter leaves and walks to work, we get the opening credits in natural environments like on the streets and building exteriors, which works thematically and visually. He calls eHarmony while waiting for the subway to find out why his wink button is broken. Patton Oswalt on the other end of the line, in a very fun role, grills him a little bit for having a lame profile where he didn't even fill out the been there, done that section. He says he's never really been anywhere or done anything. He then fantasizes about jumping off the platform and saving a dog from a building before it explodes and then giving the dog to Cheryl Melhoff. Walter scurries into the Time Life building in New York City, where he finds out the company has just been acquired, shortly before his sister appears and hands him their mother's famous Clementine cake for his birthday, which is a cake made out of Clementine oranges, not the character from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But Walter is worried because he's late. At the elevator, he and his co-workers meet Ted, who is Adam Scott, who introduces himself as the transition coordinator after the big acquisition. Ted proves to be a real asshole, insulting Walter to his face before Walter imagines having the perfect comeback he could never actually utter himself. Walter, who we learn is the negative asset manager at Life magazine, goes for coffee and then daydreams himself being a Spanish hunk that hits on Cheryl before being interrupted by Ted being an asshole again and mocking how still Walter is standing. He says ground control to Major Tom and flicks something at him. He's a real dick. Walter then walks down a bunch of stairs to his basement office, causing me to wonder why he rode the elevator all the way up in the first place. And yes, he did attempt to get coffee, but he left it there. And this basement office is huge, and there's plenty of room for a coffee maker. Why didn't he just come here directly? We meet his co-worker, and then Walter discovers a new negative role from Sean O'Connell, who is Sean Penn. He sent a note and a wallet to Walter along with the role. The note says negative 25 is the best thing he's ever shot, calling it his quintessence. But lo, an inciting incident appears in the form of there not actually being a negative 25 in the role, as it is missing. And oh no, Sean also telegrammed the magazine about Frame 25. At a floor meeting, we learn this will be the last issue of Life Magazine's physical edition. We also learn the issue goes to print in 2.5 weeks. Walter then introduces himself to Cheryl. But it's not solely because he's being brave. She also works in the department that might know where Sean O'Connell is. But she says he moves around a lot and frequently, but she'll make a phone call. We then transition from a photograph Sean took of water to Walter sitting at a public fountain, and this movie has awesome transitions. He's then approached by Cheryl. She offers to take a look at the other photos Walter is examining, but is unable to be helpful. She mentions being a mystery writing student and how the clues will eventually come together. As Cheryl leaves, he imagines himself calling after her and showing off a gold statue of them dancing. He's then called away by his sister Odessa, who is Catherine Hahn, because their mother's piano is too big to fit into her new retirement apartment, which would have 100% already been measured before this date, but whatever. So the siblings are forced to upgrade her to a villa. In the villa, Odessa gives him his old Stretch Armstrong doll. They return to the unit their mother is now packing to move back out of, and we meet his mother, who is Shirley MacLaine, and they reminisce about Walter's father. Walter then imagines going all Captain America on Ted in the elevator before they crash out of the building and have a huge chase skiing through the streets before Ted mocks him for zoning out again and tells him to get the negative. He bumps into Cheryl and shows her the picture he's found with a boat's name on it in Sean's reel. And she asks if he wants to walk up to Central Park with her. She has to pick up her son. At the park, while Cheryl is on the phone, Walter teaches her son some skateboard tips and does some sick moves that Ben Stiller is clearly not actually doing himself, although I appreciate the film's focus-based attempt to hide that from us. Before leaving the park, Walter has another daydream where Cheryl confesses her love for him, and he confesses that he has that Benjamin Buttons thing, before they share a passionate kiss, and then we cut to a tiny old Walter on a porch with normal-sized Cheryl is maybe my favorite scene. And he says, my little heart is no bigger than a quarter, but it's as full as Fort Knox. After the daydream, Cheryl tells him to ignore Beard Guy's taunts about Major Tom because it's a cool song about being brave. Back at the office, no luck finding the print, Sean O'Connell's photograph beckons Walter, who then grabs his briefcase and takes off running. On his flight to Greenland, where they've determined the boat in Sean's photo is based out of, the plane is almost entirely empty, but he's still seated directly next to another person, which is symbolic of the fact that flying utterly sucks. Walter drives to the address where something had previously been mailed to Sean, and it's a bar. He meets and chats with a drunken karaoke singer who turns out to have spent time with Sean. He's a helicopter pilot. He dropped him on a boat in the ocean, and is about to return to the boat with radio parts and offers Walter a ride. He's not dumb enough to get on a helicopter piloted by a fall-down drunk until Cheryl shows up in another fantasy and sings Space Oddity to him, inspiring him to run and jump into the helicopter just as it is taking off. And I love how the movie fuses his fantastical dream in this scene with the actual, still kind of crazy but not fantasy, action of running and jumping into the, because she's standing out there strumming in the background when he jumps into the helicopter, and I just kind of love how they blend the reality and the fantasy in this one scene. When the chopper arrives at the boat, Walter learns the thing cannot land on the boat. Pilot tells him to jump in the boat, and Walter has not seen the small skiff that is there to collect the radio parts and tries to jump into the larger boat, which is obviously too far away. Thankfully, the crew rescue him, though not before an encounter with a shark. Walter learns that Sean had left the boat only 4 hours earlier. They give him a piece of clementine cake, and then he remarks that his mother makes that cake. On the wrapper of the cake, Walter finds notes written by Sean referring to a volcano in Iceland. After the boat docks in Iceland, Walter takes a bike to the volcano after barely beating a bunch of horny Chilean deckhands to the only bike. Incidentally, horny Chilean deckhands would make an excellent band name. On the way, he gets a call from his eHarmony handler, Todd, and is finally able to help update his Been There, Done That section with a rad true story about jumping onto a helicopter and then out of a helicopter and fighting a shark. Walter then daydreams about a flock of birds taking the shape of Cheryl's face before absolutely wrecking himself into a street sign, breaking the bike. He then runs and runs and runs until he finally finds a group of kids, who agree to one of the most lopsided trades I've ever seen in my life, gifting a very nice long skateboard to Walter in exchange for a 30-year-old dirty Stretch Armstrong doll. He then meets an innkeeper that is frantically packing his car, Walter missing all the signs, and the man tells him Sean is catching an airplane the next town over soon. Walter runs and stands on a cliff, looking at how far away and how far below the next town over truly is, and realizes his only hope is to skateboard the shit out of this. And I have never wished I could skateboard in real life more than I do when watching this scene, because this looks truly thrilling as he races and bends and curves his way down the winding road to the town below. The innkeeper finally catches up to him and points out the volcano is erupting, just as Sean flies by standing on the top of a small airplane to photograph the eruption. After being rescued and enjoying some Papa John's, Walter calls Cheryl to give her some updates. He gets a text from Eduardo, his coworker, saying Beard Guy will fire Eduardo if he doesn't see Mitty soon. So Walter returns to New York, but is then fired on the sidewalk outside by Ted for not being able to produce the negative. He walks to Cheryl's house, since he somehow knows where she lives, and when he assumes Cheryl is in the relationship due to the presence of a man, he merely leaves the skateboard on the porch for her son, and instead of talking to her, he runs away. While visiting his mother and sister, Walter realizes that one of the pictures on Sean's roll is of Mrs. Mitty's piano, and then learns that Sean came to visit her recently, asking lots of questions to her about Walter. Turns out she'd already told him about it, but he had been daydreaming at the time. They talk a good while about Sean and his note about warlocks, which actually meant warlords, and I absolutely love the bit when Shirley MacLaine says he wanted to go photograph snow leopards. Isn't that neat? And Catherine Hahn, who's been there the whole time, is smelling salad dressing and says, who? It's just a hilarious beat. Walter decides to once again chase halfway around the world after Sean O'Connell, bringing along the formerly blank travel log his father had given him in his youth. He gets slapped in the face with some branches, offers clementine cake to some warlords, eats some shrubs, hikes over ice, and eventually finds Sean O'Connell at a point higher in the mountains than even the Sherpas are willing to go. On top of a mountain, he gets a call from Todd at eHarmony again, who tells him that Cheryl is no longer on the platform, before Walter finds Sean, who invites him to sit. He tells Sean about the missing negative, and Sean says, you're sitting on it, because Sean did not expect Walter to throw away the wallet like a dick. And there's a lovely moment here where Sean decides not to take the picture of the snow leopard and to keep that moment for himself. And as the two men go to join some locals playing soccer, it feels like Walter is maybe finally learning how to keep moments for himself instead of always trying to figure out what the world expects him to be in those moments. Back in the U.S., in L.A., Walter has an altercation with the TSA staff that, if I'm honest, doesn't make a ton of sense, but the movie wanted to get Walter and eHarmony Todd together for an in-person meeting, so I'll go along with it. They talk over a Cinnabon, where Todd reveals to Walter that Cheryl never responded to a single wink the entire time she was on eHarmony, and I don't think he should just be telling customers this information about other customers. Todd says Walter is nothing like he pictured him, which is kind of weird because Todd was the one verifying Walter's identity to the TSA and was helping manage his profile, which surely had a picture of Walter on it, so I'm not sure what Todd is talking about. Back in New York City, Walter and his sister help their mother sell the piano. His mother looks at the check and says, that's a heavy-duty sum. You should put that in your wallet, which is a patently stupid thing to say about a check, and I'm not even sure why the check is made out to Walter instead of his mother, but I am ready for Walter to finally find this negative, so I'm okay with all that. Walter takes the negative out of the wallet without ever looking at it and walks into Life's offices, where we see they are considering a final cover with no photo at all, but just black background and white text that reads the end of Life, which kind of does feel like something they might have done. He politely tells off Ted, who has a heartfelt moment with Eduardo in the elevator, and then starts working on his resume in a local coffee shop before he gets a message from Cheryl's son thanking him for the longboard. And how the fuck did Cheryl know Walter's personal email address? Because of serendipity, Walter runs into Cheryl when he goes to pick up his final check from Life magazine. They chat, and then Walter learns she did not get back together with her husband. He was only there that day to fix her fridge. They head uptown together, come across the last issue of Time at a newsstand with a cover featuring Walter looking at negatives. As they walk away, Walter grabs Cheryl's hand, and we fade to white. And that is the secret life of Walter Mitty, gentlemen. What did you think?
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, keep that whole end of life thing in mind when you watch this movie, because I swear to God, a lot of this feels like not real enough to be real life, and that he might be dead and all that type of stuff. All those interpretations you could have about a movie like this. But just going over a few of the notes here. I thought when the wink thing didn't work, it was going to show up on her end as like five winks. You know how that goes a lot of times, where you click on something and it says error, but it sent it through anyway. And then, like, you know, so like I kept thinking that was going to, I thought that was going to happen. I'd seen this movie before, but I had forgotten that she just didn't get the winks and this page was messed up or whatever. So, you know, it's a sort of the, come on, go ahead and just talk to her in real life. She's right there. You don't need to meet her online type of thing. So that's basically what that is. But, I like how Walter isn't like super witty or remarkable, and it takes several pushes to get him there. Like, just because he's the hero doesn't mean he has the perfect thing to say or is just simply misunderstood. I do think the movie goes a little overboard on him being a loser a little bit too much, but it's fine. It's kind of like, you know, Jamie Foxx in Spider-Man 2, kind of levels of, you know, like he just can't catch a break type of things, right, going on in this movie. I'm so used to seeing Adam Scott play very nice characters, like in Parks and Rec and Severance, that I forgot he had a stint where he often played a total dickhead. I was like stunned at how much of a dickhead he was in this movie. I had completely forgotten about that moment in time where he used to play characters like this. I'm really happy Shirley MacLaine is playing an older woman who isn't just there for comic relief or to nag her children or whatever stereotype. She's not forgetful. She has true wisdom. Mm. I love her in this. She's like an actual, like, real well-rounded character, I feel like, in this thing. I do love that Benjamin Button fantasy. The thing about it that really makes it for me is that he doesn't know what the story of the Curious Case of Benjamin Button is. So his fantasy is wrong. And it's just like, he's got that condition where he gets smaller. And so like he has a whole fantasy where he gets smaller, but older. I just thought that was a really good touch, in that whole thing. Boy, does Walter, he sure does stumble on the stuff from the photos easily in this movie. Yeah. Almost makes me wonder if even the real stuff in this movie is really a fantasy, but especially when he fantasizes about Cheryl singing Space Oddity and he jumps on the drunk guy's helicopter as it takes off. I don't know if it's a fantasy or not, but seeing Sean on top of that plane with camera in hand flying towards the volcano is hilarious. I love that shot. Like, he's that much of a badass photographer that he would just stand on a biplane going towards an erupting volcano. I love it. Yeah, maybe I just missed it. Why the fuck does Walter toss that wallet? I don't get it. I don't get it at all. And he's like, thank God he did it in his mom's house.
Yeah.
Perhaps the worst part of the movie, but quirky enough to be interesting and not a fatal flaw, is Sean and how he does things. Leaving the important photo in the wallet and expecting Walter to see it. Visiting his mom without him knowing. Mm. I mean, I thought Sean really liked Walter and appreciated him, so it's weird he never comes to personally visit him, especially after what his mom tells him that Sean came by to see her for. You know, I wanted to know where he's going next, what his schedule's like, and all that. Why don't you just go and talk to him yourself? And then, like, I guess it's possible Sean looks up to Walter and the way that Walter looks up to Sean and is just shy. I don't know. This is another reason why I don't even know if the things that happened in this movie happened. Walter is Walter just Cobb in Inception and doesn't know it? Is he in limbo? I don't know. I kind of love that detail that Cheryl left eHarmony because she started falling for Walter, but they never mention it outright.
Mm.
I very much enjoy the little break where they play soccer, even though just before that, Sean once again makes it frustrating by not telling Walter what the picture is.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, my final note is, I didn't look, and then I wrote, yeah, right. So that's it.
Oh, man. Aaron?
So if you remember last week, I said it's been probably over a decade since I've seen this movie, and I remember enjoying parts and not liking parts, and I had the same experience this time, and just constant reminder after reminder of the things I loved and the things that I really didn't enjoy. So I think I will jump off of something Chris said about not knowing what's real and what's not. I think that's a really... maybe not a fatal flaw, but I think it's a really damaging flaw for this movie. And the reason is this, because the movie seems to be trying to make a point about embracing real life over fantasy, right? Like mm-hmm. finding joy and excitement in reality in your world instead of what's fantasy. So if we don't know what's real and what's not, we have a harder time understanding what makes reality better than fantasy. Right? Like, what makes it different? What makes it more interesting? What makes it, you know, more real? And like, Jeremy, you were saying you liked how they combined the reality and fantasy and that jumping on the helicopter. And I'm just sitting here going, did they combine? Was that? I thought all of that was fantasy. I thought, he got on the helicopter, but I don't think he jumped on the helicopter.
That's
like,
fascinating to me. That's fascinating to me. When you're done, I'll have some thoughts about the fantasy versus reality interpretations.
Sure. So, and again, this, I will say, to sum up my experience, it's probably better to say, like, this is a really fun movie to watch. I really love a lot of the asides, the dreams, the visual interpretation of the fantasies is so cool and so fun.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is probably the accent that Stiller does when he's the mountain climber. It's so good and perfect. And I have a lot of fun watching this movie. So it's a fun movie to watch. This is for me. A fun movie to watch, but not a fun movie to think about. The second I start trying to really think about this movie, I kind of lose interest because I don't know that the movie ever really defines things enough for me to get a real grasp on what it's saying or what it's doing. I also think there's enough nonsense in this movie that it kind of contradicts itself or undercurrents itself. The Todd stuff is entirely nonsense. Like that a person from eHarmony that's there to, like, their job, if you know anybody who answers phones for a company, they're not investing any time in anybody's life, let alone going to see them. So that just feels like, you know, complete nonsense. There's also a comparison to the original, which maybe isn't fair, but if you've seen the Danny Kaye original, it's so good at us understanding what makes this guy likable and interesting and fun and what is keeping him from actually seeing his life. And again, I don't necessarily want to spoil the original, but it's very different in that the movie uses the fantasy and what's reality to actually push the plot forward. Like, what, you know, like the idea that it uses the comedy of his family and friends not believing him because he's saying these fantastical things that actually happened because they know he's a dreamer. Like, there's none of that here. And in fact, this Walter Mitty is kind of a downer. Like, anytime I'm spending time with him, I don't find him likable. I just find him to be really morose. And that I think impacts my ability to watch it as well. Chris, were you saying you felt like the Cheryl character was really well-rounded? Did I hear that correctly? No,
I think he was talking about the mom.
No, the mom.
The mom, yes. Okay, good. Because the Cheryl character I did not think was really...
No, she's not at all. It's not believable that they are even in love, really, other than the movie says they are or whatever.
Yeah, my thought while watching it was, this is textbook Manic Pixie Dream Girl, just without doing the Manic Pixie part. Like, it's kind of that textbook woman put in, you know, to inspire you to, you know... do more with your life.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things too, when you are first really introduced to her, like, is her eHarmony account, and you're like, oh, she seems light and fun,
yeah,
and whatever, and then
yeah,
and then when he meets her in real life, I mean you could say that this is what it is like to see someone's online persona versus their real persona or whatever, but I'm kind of expecting that kind of character to be interacted with in real life as well. And we only really interact with her that way when we see the fantasies and everything. She's like, right. It's Kristen Wiig. She's completely game to be into these humorous fantasy things, but like in the real life or whatever, she's just there. She's kind of just there. Yeah, that's just the way it goes.
And again, this comes down to the muddled tones and messages for me, but if the movie is about embracing actual life, and this is what I'm saying about needing to know what's actual, like, did he really beat a shark with a briefcase? Did that really happen? Did he really escape from a volcano? Did that really happen?
Yes.
I'm excited to hear how you know that. But if it did, is real life only exciting and worth embracing when it's as crazy as a fantasy, right? Like, that's a different message than the actual reality and authenticity of our world is what's worth investing in. If the message is, no, your real life is only worth it if you're, you know, beating up sharks and escaping from volcanoes.
I think the message is, go live life.
And that's
Stop
what I'm saying.
Fantasizing about it.
Right. So what is living life? Beating sharks over the head and escaping volcanoes? Or is it
grabbing the girl's hand on the sidewalk at the end?
Exactly. But that's not what this movie seems to be saying. Like, that's...
To you.
Right. Correct. To me. And again, as long as I can be clear on this, I think it's because the movie is muddled on what is real and what is fantasy.
That I just don't agree with. Like, I think the movie is extremely clear about what is fantasy and what is real. Mm. And I don't think this movie is anywhere near as deep as a movie that would try and blur that line to make you think. So for me, like, I feel like you mentioned how the fantasies are visually exciting and interesting. That, to me, tells me when I'm watching a fantasy and when I'm not. Like, jumping on a helicopter right before it takes off is crazy, but it's not jumping through a brick wall of a building, rescuing a dog, skateboarding on the street and tearing up the asphalt, fighting with a Stretch Armstrong. Like, I feel like the movie goes out of its way to let you know when you're in a fantasy. So it's surprising to me that both of you feel the opposite, and that could just mean I'm in the minority and I'm fine with that. But no, I think he really did jump on the helicopter. I think he really did jump in the water. I think he really did hit a shark with his briefcase because the briefcase is broken after that. I think he really did get rescued from a volcano by the Icelandic guy. I think Sean really was standing on the plane as he flew by. And I think the movie chooses to make him embracing life and living life these extreme things, and that's maybe not a choice you agree with, but I don't think the movie is asking you to debate which scenes are real and which scenes are fantasy.
I think you're right, Jeremy. It's just that when the stuff falls into place as it does in this during the reality, that's where I have trouble figuring out whether or not they're saying, is this really happening? Because, oh, he just happened to take a picture of the piano. He took a picture of that dude's thumb. He, you know, it's like, this is where it strains your credulity about all the things. And it's not like Sean's out there, I better take pictures of all this stuff so that he'll go and find me later. He's hoping that he'll find it in the wallet. It's, I don't know why those pictures would be in his role.
You're touching on my biggest problem with the movie, which is that role of film. It makes no sense at all. Sean O'Connor, right, a photographer, only takes one frame of a thing he's taking a picture of. Come on, professional photographers take 60 frames of the thing they're trying to take a picture of. So that role would have 60 pictures of the words in the water of the boat. And he also only had one roll in the camera while he's in Greenland, then Iceland, then New York City, and then Himalayas. And he's like, I don't understand that roll of film at all. But yeah. Again, I
no,
think...
No, it makes no sense.
I think the movie is... doesn't really care. I think the movie is just trying to make it work out for Walter.
I totally agree with you that I think the movie believes it thinks that the reality afterwards is reality or whatever. As soon as the it marries it with the space oddity and him jumping on the helicopter, it's presenting that to you as real. I do agree with that. It's just that it's hard to accept it when everything is so fantastical after that. And maybe that's the movie's point and whatever, but it's too neat. It's just way too neat and everything. So that's sort of where, and yes, I see in the chat is like, you know, he doesn't find Sean and first and he gets fired and all these different things happening to him or whatever. But still his journey, the whole point of the movie is his journey to find him and everything. And all the things that he does to find him and all the things he does to finally have this exciting life and be that ABC that, you know, Cheryl loves in her eHarmony account happens because of this stuff that, oh, I'm able to notice that this is a piano and this is a guy's thumb and all that. All that's too neat. It's just too neat. And that's why I wondered if maybe it's, you know, he's just dead, you know, maybe he's just dead the whole time. We're talking about the end of life in this movie, very literally. So
I mean, I welcome all interpretations. I certainly think that would be dark as hell if that was actually what the movie was trying to say. A few other things I wanted to say that I'd made notes on. One was the use of color in the film. I mentioned it in the first scene, but I really appreciate the layered use of color here. I also appreciate he does a lot of interesting things with words on the screen here, both with the opening credits, but then the Life magazine motto as he's running to the airport is appearing on the background on like airport signs and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I think it's cool that a movie about searching for a photograph still takes care to point out how important words can be in telling human stories. I just thought that was an interesting visual flair. My last note is from IMDb trivia. And it seems there's speculation that the blue car, red car is a nod to the Matrix and taking the red pill to stay in Wonderland and see how deep the rabbit hole goes. I couldn't find any confirmation of that. But I do love that interpretation. That may just be a great internet theory. But anyway, yeah, you know, I liked it more than you guys, but it's
it is fun to watch. And I actually think it's worth, pointing out. I think Chris and I are having two kind of different issues with the non-reality stuff. Because I think if I'm understanding you correctly, Chris, is more about how the rest of the movie just feels too convenient, too easy, too, like, it just, everything feels like
it makes you question whether the reality that they are presenting that they truly believe is real and you should now accept this really strains the credulity as it goes along. So yes, I am having a slight different issue than you are.
Whereas my issue is I don't think the movie does a good job at distinguishing between fantasy and reality. Mm-hmm. I'll ask you about one scene in particular, just because I'm thinking about it. When Cheryl has her back turned and he's showing the kid how to skateboard, is he really that good at skateboarding or is that fantasy?
I think the movie is saying he's really that good at skateboarding.
I think he is because that was one scene that I had sort of delved into, is that if he was truly amazing at that skateboard, I think we would have seen him doing all sorts of tricks and going all over Central Park and... You know, just I in fact think they kind of I think it's important to show that he is really good at this, but they almost kind of missed a really good opportunity to have him do a fantasy sequence there where he's just like burning through Central Park and like doing all these tricks and everything, and she's just on the phone the whole time, and then by the time he's done and everybody's like clapping and whatever, she turns around and nothing's going on or whatever.
But they did somehow, they brought in like one of the top trick skateboard guys in the sport. when they film this, and that's who's doing those tricks in that scene. I think what the movie's trying to do is set up the skateboarding scene later in Iceland, and they probably went a little too far overboard with the fanciness of the tricks. But I do think the movie is saying he's really doing those tricks.
Yeah, it's probably a me thing. It's probably a me problem. I do have a tendency to overthink process movies in a way that they're not intending. But
this thing was only a 78 on Rotten Tomatoes. Plenty of people didn't jive with it. Jive?
Sure, why not?
And like I said, I remember it being not as liked as this as much as it is now back when it first came out. Mm-hmm. I feel like nobody really liked it when it first came out, and then it has grown in appreciation over the years. By the way, this movie's soundtrack, whoever was responsible for that definitely listened to a bunch of Alt Nation on Sirius XM back in the day. I love the soundtrack.
Like, I love when that Arcade Fire song kicks in when he's running to the airport. Yes. That's freaking awesome.
Arcade Fire made their best album like back in 2000, I think it was 2003, the funeral album, I believe, or whatever. And that's what that song's off of. And it's just thinking about how long they've been around since that album came out. And like, just imagine putting out your best work then and then. Yeah, they've done okay since then. It's just that's their magnum opus, that whole album that came out way back then. And, you know, they've never really been able to match that since. Mm. But it is a great moment, that song.
I also wanted to mention, I did like this movie. I did like watching this movie as much as it
you
sounds
did say
like
that.
It.
Yeah, no, I didn't feel like you were stomping on it or anything.
Have you guys seen the original? Have you guys watched the Danny Kaye?
I haven't.
Yes, but it's been 25 years. 30 years.
I would recommend it for, if nothing else, some of the stuff he does in some of the dream sequences. There's a music professor bit in one of the dream sequences from the original that is like top five physical comedy. Mm. And by physical, I mean facial in this case. I don't mean falling over. Like it's like make them laugh Donald O'Connor, stuff that
Danny
he's doing.
Danny Kaye can do it all,
his vocalizations.
Love me some Danny Kaye.
He's a really impressive dude.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
What do you got, Aaron?
I consider some others that I'll talk about after Chris goes, just in case I would accidentally steal something. But I went with what I felt was my best match, and that's Big Fish.
I
really feel like it's doing a lot of the same thematic work about what's real, what's not, what's important, what's not. Are big stories, you know, worth believing, experiencing? And, you know, there's a relational aspect to it as well, although in this case it's fathers and sons, not necessarily significant others. But yeah, Big Fish, I think, would make a very tonal double feature with this.
Good one. I like it.
I haven't seen that movie since it came out. I remember very much disliking it a lot. And maybe I should give it another whirl at some point, but I just remember I used to love you, Tim Burton. I used to love every movie you came out with, and now it just seems like everything you make is just wrong, man. Just wrong.
maybe I don't recommend watching it again. It sounds like it was a bad experience.
I don't know. I'll give it another chance. But I never saw that other one where it was. What was about? Was it the weird eyes or
big eyes?
Big eyes. Oh, so he's got big fish and big eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes,
I didn't ever see
the
that.
Third in the
big Top Pee Wee.
Did he direct that one?
I don't think he did that one. He did the first one. He didn't do Big Top.
It's unfortunate.
It's still funny. I wish he did, but it's still funny. My super secret double feature is something I feel like it got mentioned as an alternative, but it wasn't the official one. I even looked at our list of super secret double features over the years, and I did not see it, or I overlooked it. But my super secret double feature comes from this very year. It has been a big recommend on this podcast, and that's Her. I thought Her would be a really good double feature. It's another character where Joaquin Phoenix is kind of down in the dumps, doesn't know what to do with his life, and then he meets the woman of his dreams, just so happens to be a digital woman, but, you know, meets the woman of his dreams who, like, really improves and expands his life in a huge way all the way through it. So, that's a movie that I thought would go along well with this one. So.
The chat says more Arcade Fire in Her.
Exactly. It's true.
Her has maybe one of the most uncomfortable sex scenes in any movie I've ever seen.
Also, Kristen Wiig was
the cat.
Kristen Wiig was the voice of the cat choker woman in there.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I also considered Everything Everywhere All at Once as a nice double feature with this, mm-hmm. with some of the fantastical stuff. Mm-hmm. Amelie, I think.
Ooh, nice.
Amelie would be great with this, yeah.
And then the Stretch one was the Stretch Armstrong one was Never Ending Story, which is interesting because it's kind of that get your head out of the clouds, you know, kind of live in the real world. Kind of thing. What's real? What's fancy? Anyways,
I totally like those. I like that a lot. I don't like all of those. So. All right. Next week, what is our homework, Aaron? It's your choice. What are we watching?
So, Chris did Sorcerer, which is a remake of The Wages of Fear. Jeremy did Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is a remake of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Kind of remakes of already, you know, respected movies. That are done in a different way, done in a new way. And so I'm going with something in that same category with 310 to Yuma.
Oh,
nice.
What a good one.
So this is the modern one, but yes, it is also a remake of a classic Western, 310 to Yuma. So yeah,
I'm going to super secret double feature 310 to Yuma with 310 to Yuma.
It makes total sense.
That's a good one. I think I've seen the original 310 to Yuma, and I like this James Mangold version better. This one's a little bit more exciting, I think. But anyway, I don't remember.
This is the movie that made me stand up and take notice of Ben Foster from the year forward.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to watch this again.
All right, looks like we have time for a question or two.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Let's see. Take a movie role that was so perfectly cast that the fans believe it should never be recast at all and recast it. Not an entire movie. Just a single role that people say was perfectly cast, like Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool or RDJ as Iron Man. And you know what? I think everyone was asking for Patrick Stewart to play Charles Xavier before he was even cast, so they got their wish there. But I think Ben Kingsley would have been great in that role, too. If we're looking for someone who is closer in age to Patrick Stewart when he first played Xavier, then I'd go with Jude Law. But, that's what I would answer this question.
Mm-hmm. I went with, instead of J.K. Simmons, who is perfect as J. Jonah Jameson, nobody would ever want to recast that. What about John C. McGinley? You may know him from Scrubs and some other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, yeah, he'd be perfect.
I think he would make a great J. Jonah, so that was my thought.
I mean, all he has to really do is play his character from Scrubs as J. Jonah Jameson. It's pretty much the same sort of
thing. Do we have any explanation yet from the MCU why J. Jonah Jameson looks the same in Tobey Maguire's universe and Tom Holland's universe?
I mean, other than the multiverse stuff where everything can just be whatever it wants to be.
But I'm saying, I don't mind J. Jonah Jameson being in both universes, but I feel like it was a mistake to hire him again for the Tom Holland movies because that confuses my brain. Because I don't understand why Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker doesn't look like Tom Holland.
Yeah, everybody's a different person in the other universe, is what you're saying.
They're except for Jonah Jameson,
human just being,
and that's because but then J. Jonah of this question.
J. Jonah Jameson is inevitable.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that they felt there's nobody better. He's perfect. Let's never recast the role, so they cast him back in it.
There's other characters that are the same, played by the same actor in different dimensions too. Like I think of Wolverine, or you know, Hugh Jackman played several of the versions of Wolverine.
I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, well, I'm just saying.
And that's just and breaking the same rule they broke with J. Jonah James.
Yeah. I wonder if we even factor in Deadpool and Wolverine interpretation of everything anyway.
Well, there were a bazillion Kangs that all look like that actor.
Yeah.
So it feels like No Way Home is the movie I really have a problem with because they put Toby and Andrew in it, and that was all fan service, and still like watching. Okay, I probably should answer this question. I'll go with the controversy. I think, and I'm this is coming from somebody who's oversaturated with Ryan Reynolds at this point in my life, but I think Ryan Reynolds would have been fine, if not great, as Iron Man. Or Tony Stark. Mm. I think he could have nailed that charm and wit and sarcasm. And, you know, it just annoys me when people say they should never recast Tony Stark.
Well, I've got a surprise for you, Jeremy. What? In the next Avengers movie, there's going to be a point where Iron Man crash lands next to, you know, Doctor Doom. And we're going to be like, oh, is this going to be a face-off between the Robert Downey Juniors? But no, he clicks his button, his armor comes off, and it's Ryan Reynolds.
Man, if that happens, I will walk out of the theater. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens. If Iron Man shows up, but it's not Robert Downey Jr., I don't know. I feel like they've made it to where anything can happen, so I don't even bother speculating anymore.
They really have.
It's probably whoever...
It doesn't look like... Oh, sorry,
no, I was just saying, it'll probably just be whoever played Doctor Doom in the Fox movies will just show up as Iron Man.
No, it won't, because it's Julian McMahon, so no, it won't, unfortunately. Yeah, so... on that note, yeah, let's see. Looks over the chat has finally caught up to us here. History Lover says, well, like Judy Dench in the Pierce Brosnan's James Bond being, she's talking about, the Judy Dench being part of the same universe as the two.
That bothered
Bonds.
Me
Although
too.
The Bonds are always, there's always that theory. I don't think they've ever said that, come out and said this or anything. There's always that theory that whoever is James Bond 007, it's just a code name and it's not really someone who's born James Bond on their birth certificate or whatever. But, you know, I guess it kind of fits that mold. Nolan says, instead of Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer, how about an American like Andrew Garfield?
He's
American.
English and American. When you Google him, it says, I'm looking at it right now because I saw that comment and I was confused, and it says American actor under his name. And then when you go to the overview, Andrew Garfield is an English American actor. He must have an English parent and an American parent, I'm guessing. I don't think of him as American.
And And then Tatsu says, I can't think of who, but somebody else is Wolverine. Okay, I'll say Ludacris as Wolverine. Yeah, Ludacris as Wolverine. Now that would be entertaining. I would definitely watch Ludacris as Wolverine.
Okay, so
no doubt about it.
Andrew Garfield, born in America, moved to the UK when he was 3 years old and raised there. So that explains.
Okay. All right. Okay. You better lawyer up, asshole.
Did you ever see the clip of Dylan O'Brien doing that monologue? Like, he posted it on social media. It's awesome. You can tell he's a
I need
huge
to see
fan
that.
Of that. I'll try and find the clip.
I like Dylan O'Brien a lot. Yeah, he's great. I'd like to see that. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Next week is 310 to Yuma, the James Mangold, more modern version. Chat, once again, thank you for coming out. We appreciate you so much for coming out and watching us today. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Can you do with that? Can you get with this?
Be a part part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com. All I know is I'm glad that I didn't wear one of my red shirts today.
Oh, well, you don't want to match me?
Mm-hmm. You guys kind of it would have looked weird. Yeah, kind of. Mine's a little lighter, I guess.
Kind of grayscale.
Yeah.
Pop of color in the middle.
All I do is grayscale.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
Isn't that the disease in Game of Thrones that what's his name gets?
Uh-huh.
No, it's, what is it called?
It's something scale. I thought it was
grayscale.
It's
by the power of grayscale.
It's big week.
It's a big week. Why is it a big
Go
week?
Go ahead. Well, I was just gonna say it's Ryder Cup week.
Oh, yes.
It's Friday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'm gonna be glued in to the golf.
Who's hosting this year?
The U.S. Okay. And we stupidly decided to play it at Bethpage Black, which is like the devil's golf course. It's like the hardest course in the world. So I don't know what's going to happen. Anybody could blow up at any point on that course.
Do they call it Bethpage Black because there's another Bethpage?
Yes, it's the Bethpage Black course, and I don't know what the other Bethpage course or courses is called.
Well, I would hope it's not Bethpage White and that it didn't come from a history of segregation.
Yes.
Because no kidding. Terrible.
But you know Let's what? See. It would make total sense. It would. It?
Knowing golf, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Bethpage State Park. It's a public course, which is ironic because it's got a giant sign in front of the first tee that's like, probably shouldn't play this course, is essentially what it says.
This course is like, it's the equivalent
of having crocodiles snapping at you as you shoot, as you
yes,
take shots.
I have had that. I've been chased by a crocodile on a golf course.
Yeah, there are 5 total Bethpage courses.
You said that with a note of seriousness, Aaron, that makes me think that it actually happened.
No, that actually happened. Yeah. Yeah. Hit a golf ball into a swampy looking area and then went looking for the golf ball. And apparently there was a large mama gator there nesting. And, you know, golf balls look a lot like alligator eggs. I don't know if you know this, no, anyways, we must have gotten too close because, yeah, she came after us. She chased us a good 15 feet out of the water. So,
least they're not that hell-bent on revenge that they just chase you until they get you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was protective. It wasn't lunch, you know.
Well,
yeah.
And I played, my parents live in Florida. I've played Florida golf courses a handful of times with my dad, and there's always alligators on the course, and I've never been chased by them. I've just, you know, keep my eye on them. Now, I did have a confrontation with a sandhill crane. I don't know if you've ever seen a sandhill crane, but they're big as fuck. It was 6 foot tall, and it had babies, and I got too close, and it was right in front of me, jumping up and down, squawking and flapping its wings, and I abandoned that golf ball. I left it behind.
It doesn't appear that the pictures do this justice, but I can imagine this bird being very huge.
Oh, no, it's not doing justice.
Chris, do you have any legit phobias? Things you're scared of that really get under your skin?
If he doesn't, I have one.
I don't think so. I mean, if you were to go letter the law to the point that I can't go and do something because of the phobia, no. I have a little bit of a fear of heights, just a tad bit. But still, when I went to the Sears, Don't Call Me Willis Tower, and they have this, you know, box that you can go into and there's glass underneath and all that, I got on it.
Oh my God.
And looked down.
Even now, I'm freaking out about that.
So, no, I wouldn't say there's anything to that point where I'm phobic to the point that I won't do something like that is otherwise safe or whatever.
Right. That's exactly my same answer. I get scared of heights, but only when my life is in danger. Right. So like the Sears Tower thing doesn't scare me because, you know, I know the engineering that went into it. I know I'm standing on glass. I know, you know, those kind of things. It's not just seeing how high I am that makes me scared. It's seeing how high I am and knowing I could fall. Like that's, you know, what, like,
or really feeling the building sway back and forth.
There's that.
Most recent season of Top Chef, which was Canada set. They did a challenge that I thought was extremely unfair, where before the challenge, they took everybody up to that huge tower in Toronto. I don't remember what it's called, but you guys
CN Tower.
Okay. And apparently, if you are a tourist, you can go up there and they will strap you in and you can go out and walk along the edge of the thing. And so Top Chef, they said, if you go up to the tower, you'll get a 5-minute extra time. If you go out on the edge and clip in, you'll get 10 minutes extra time. If you walk around the whole thing while clipped in, you'll get 15 minutes extra cook time. Now, I'm getting the times, the rewards wrong, but the point is, anybody who is scared of heights in that group of contestants was absolutely screwed by that challenge. And everybody else who wasn't scared of heights got more cook time just because the show didn't know about phobias.
And what exactly is an extra 5 minutes here and there anyway when you're cooking? I mean, come on.
I'm probably under-exaggerating what those times
were. Oh, they may have gotten like 30 minutes or something like that.
It may have been much more substantial. I don't remember what it was, but I was just so livid that the challenge was like, I don't understand why you would base a cooking challenge on somebody's fear of heights.
But Jeremy, it so clearly has so much to do with cooking. You know, it's clearly it's so thematically sound. How could they not do it?
They interweave the long tradition of fear of heights. And
I mean, clearly what they're doing is accepting some money from the Toronto Tourism Board to promote this activity for tourists and make sure that people watching in America know that this is a thing you can do. And usually the show isn't quite that ridiculous. Usually they stick to cooking for the most part, but every now and then they do something really dumb like that.
I've been up in the CN Tower, but I was 9 years old when that happened, so I don't remember much. I think there's a restaurant at the top of the tower that's and then once you're up in the top of that's the round thing that goes around, and there's the little needle that goes above it. You can then, if you want to, go up into the needle, which I think is what we did. We ended up doing that, and you can see, like, you know, it's one of those things where you can see 35 states or some crap like that. Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's that many or whatever. You can see a lot of stuff from the top of the tower.
That'd be amazing if you could see 35 U.S. states from the tower in Toronto.
Right, right, awesome. Exactly.
You might
get including
Michigan.
Hawaii and Alaska.
At the same time.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.